Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Michael Williams for a lymphoma CLL update, and we began our conversation with new developments in indolent lymphoma.
I think the most important things relate to the studies in low tumor burden follicular lymphoma. That was the focus of the RESORT trial. So took patients who could traditionally be offered just watch and wait and deferred therapy, and we treated them with four doses of rituximab, standard therapy, and then for those who responded, either a partial or complete remission, then the experimental part was to just observe them after that and retreat them with four doses of rituximab when they progress, or test maintenance where they got one dose of rituximab every 3 months indefinitely. And what we found in follicular is that for the low tumor burden patients, there was no benefit to doing maintenance as compared with just retreating them when they need it. And what was fascinating is that we confirmed what other studies had suggested, and that is that there's patients who may go 3-5 years and beyond with just four doses of rituximab and have no recurrence. So you can get very durable remissions in some patients in that population with just four doses of Rituxan. For the higher tumor burden patients, symptomatic, they clearly need therapy. The PRIMA study that was published in Lancet about a year and a half ago showed that there was a benefit for maintenance rituximab after rituximab plus chemotherapy. So those, I'd say, are the two highest impact studies that have come out. The other area of excitement are in some of the newer targeted agents that we'll be talking about perhaps a little bit later.
Right, for sure. I want to talk about some of the new small molecules. But just getting back to the RESORT trial, one of the things that I think I've been hearing people say, investigators, since that was kind of what you were talking about. Even though it was focused on the issue of maintenance, the question of, because of what was demonstrated, there are people more likely to utilize rituximab up front as opposed to watch and wait.
I think over time we'll probably see that trend. In my own practice, what I typically would do is for a patient who has low tumor burden, is asymptomatic, I'll discuss with them the option of watch and wait and get a sense of what the pace of the disease is going to be. And if they're comfortable with that and they prefer to just be followed without active treatment right now, then I think that's perfectly fine. If they are either anxious about watch and wait or just, you know, feel more secure for whatever reason to proceed, then I think the four doses of rituximab without doing maintenance is perfectly justifiable from the phase 3 data.
I've heard people say that they are thinking about it, particularly in the older patient who they would like to delay as long as possible receiving chemotherapy. Is that your thought too?
Yes. I mean, that's certainly part of the discussion, is that if we get a good response with their earlier low tumor burden disease, that that may well, and it appears that it does delay the time to chemotherapy, at least in the higher tumor burden patients. On the PRIMA study showed that.
You also mentioned the patient who's higher tumor burden, who's going to get our chemo up front, and the issue of maintenance there. Any questions that you get from oncologists in practice about those kinds of scenarios?
We do get questions. In that patient population, I think maintenance has been adopted much more widely. I think the thing to keep in mind is that there's not a huge difference between the two arms, and that many of those patients will again go for years, you know, 3, 4, 5 years after our chemo alone, and when they show progression, can respond to single agent rituximab. So there's a modest benefit. I think doing maintenance for 2 years after induction is reasonable, but I consider it not mandatory at this point. So it's a decision point where I discuss it with patients and see what their interest and comfort level is.
Where are we right now in terms of other anti-CD20 antibodies? I know there's one that seems pretty similar to rituximab, and there's others out there. What do we know about these agents?
So there's a second agent, ofatumumab, that's available now and approved for treating relapsed CLL, and that one's been shown to have activity even in rituximab-resistant patients. Even though it is, as you said, another anti-CD20, it binds a different epitope on that protein and so can have activity. And then there are several new antibodies in development that have been designed or engineered to have a different efficiency and a better efficiency in maximizing the effector cell response. natural killer cells.
Anything that you've seen that sways you one way or the other to whether this is going to be part of our future or not?
I think it's too early to say. The preliminary studies with these newer antibodies haven't shown a dramatic benefit over rituximab. So I think waiting for a little more maturity on the phase 3 data is going to be helpful there.
Any comments in general in terms of B-cell disease, in terms of the issue of lenalidomide and also the issue of lenalidomide rituximab, the so-called R-square regimen?
Yeah, that's an area of just a lot of interest right now. So lenalidomide certainly has activity in a variety of B-cell malignancies, of course myeloma where it's approved, but also in CLL, mantle cell lymphoma, other indolent lymphomas, and it's being tested in subsets of patients with large cell lymphoma. So it's an active agent by itself, but the R-squared for lenalidomide and rituximab, there's rationale from preclinical work with that combination showing that in the presence of lenalidomide, the effector cell binding and interaction with rituximab-labeled tumor cells or lymphoma cells is enhanced. And so you can get an additive or even synergistic anti-tumor effect with those. So that's a combination that, as I said, has a lot of interest right now. It's being tested in cooperative group trials as a maintenance therapy in mantle cell lymphoma. It's being used, actually, there's a follicular study that's going to test it in the frontline setting. So a non-chemotherapy, immunomodulatory, immunotherapy induction that I think is intriguing and exciting. And I'm sure we're going to see high response rates there.
You know, it's interesting, you know, these IMiDs, I ask a lot of people how they think work. Of course, in our myeloma series, we talk about these all the time. But the idea of combining an immune modulatory agent and a monoclonal antibody, it kind of theoretically seems like it makes sense. Actually, in myeloma, it looks like there's some activity with lenalidomide and elotuzumab. Any thoughts about mechanistically, biologically, you know, how rituximab works and why it might be enhanced by the presence of a drug like lenalidomide?
Well, I think part of it relates to this enhancement of the effector cell interaction. So the immune synapse that forms, for example, between an NK cell and a cytotoxic T cell with rituximab-labeled tumor cells is one piece of it. But as you suggest, there's really multiple mechanisms here, and I think there's no doubt that the microenvironment effect, that these tumor cells are very dependent on cytokine interactions with stromal cells in the bone marrow and in the lymph node, and that lenalidomide and other IMiDs can disrupt those networks and make the cells more vulnerable to, you know, either cytotoxic therapy or immunotherapy. So we don't have as clear an understanding as we would like, especially in the sense of being able to rationally design regimens and approaches and schedules optimally, but I think we understand enough that the trials that are ongoing are going to be informative.
What about some of the small molecules that are being studied in B-cell disease? And I know you've been involved with some of this research. There's the Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor. I think it's called ibrutinib now. And then what used to be called Cal-101, a PI3 kinase inhibitor. What do you know about these agents?
Yeah, so those, I'd say, are among the most exciting agents in the field right now. And if you take a look at the B-cell receptor signaling pathway, upon which a lot of, certainly the indolent B-cell malignancies are dependent upon, there are a variety of tyrosine kinase targets along that pathway, some of them in the proximal part or near the receptor, such as Bruton tyrosine kinase and PI3 kinase delta. A little further down the pathway is AKT, NF-kappa-B, mTOR. So there are a variety of places upstream and downstream in that pathway that are targetable. And we now have several agents that show either very good to striking clinical activity, such as the Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitor ibrutinib that you mentioned. There's the PI3 kinase delta Cal-101, which is now GS-1011 is the new designation for that. Also up in this upstream part is SYK, S-Y-K, and there is a SYK inhibitor. Fostamatinib is one that's been studied and shows activity in large cell lymphoma, being tested now in other settings. And then further downstream, there are a variety of inhibitors, and of course the NF-kappa-B inhibitors like the proteasome inhibiting agents and mTOR inhibitors like everolimus and temsirolimus. So that's a long laundry list of agents, but I mention them all because they're all in active clinical trials. They've all got varying degrees of activity. And I think one of the challenges we're going to have is figuring out exactly when and where to use them and sort of how best can we combine them or sequence them to move away from, at least to some extent, from standard cytotoxic treatments and to get deeper and longer lasting remissions.
I want to ask you also about an older treatment that I've been kind of curious about over the last few years, and we have seen a little bit of data coming out in indolent lymphomas, and that is radioimmune therapy. Anything that's come out recently, is it a strategy that you use in your own practice outside a trial setting, and in what situations?
Right. So the radioimmunotherapeutics, at least up until perhaps these very recent agents that we talked about, both yttrium-90 ibrutumumab and I-131 tocilizumab, have been the two most active single agents in the relapse setting, for example, for follicular lymphoma. So we will use them, especially in older patients where, you know, you can basically do the treatment in a week. It's sort of a one-time thing. Response rates are high, and some patients get very durable responses. So we'll often use it for patients in that setting. It has been used for consolidation therapy. Mitchell Smith just published the results of an ECOG trial in mantle cell with four doses of rituximab CHOP followed by radioimmunotherapy. So you can do it. It's safe. You can get responses. You know, how it would compare with other approaches, say maintenance rituximab, is unknown. So it's useful for consolidation in that setting. It's useful based upon the FIT data from Europe in follicular lymphoma patients who have achieved either a complete or a partial remission to do consolidation with radioimmunotherapy. And the other setting where it's being tested and occasionally used is for patients who are heading to an auto transplant. So sometimes it's used and being studied by the group out at Fred Hutchinson, using that as the total body radiotherapy by using higher doses of radioimmunotherapy.
Is there any interest in looking at R-chemo followed by radioimmune therapy followed by R-maintenance in indolent lymphomas?
Yeah, there is some interest in that, and I believe that that's been piloted by SWOG, sort of building on their study of CHOP followed by I-131 tocilizumab. So that phase 3 study, at least, with R-CHOP versus CHOP I-131 radioimmunotherapy showed similar outcomes, but they're testing it to see whether some additional maintenance therapy may build on that response and give patients a better durability of their remission.
Let's talk a little bit about CLL. Anything new that's come out in the last couple of years? You know, obviously, we talked about new agents, but in terms of trials that have practical import in terms of management of CLL, and also special populations such as patients with 17p deletions, older patients.
Yeah, so we're getting a better handle, I think, on risk adapting therapy, recognizing that patients who have symptomatic disease and a poor risk marker like the 17p deletion probably need to be carved out for other treatment approaches. In terms of specific agents, I'd say the most important new treatments that are available now for hematology oncology practitioners would include ofatumumab that we mentioned earlier. It would include lenalidomide, which has good activity, or potentially the R-squared approach that you mentioned. And ibrutinib has been, again, strikingly active in the CLL population, as have other B-cell receptor pathway inhibitors. One of the interesting things about ibrutinib in that population is that you get a mobilization of cells so that often for days or maybe even a few weeks after ibrutinib is started in CLL, patients actually have a rise, sometimes a considerable rise, in their circulating lymphocyte count, and that correlates exactly with spleen and lymph node size decreasing, and then over time that lymphocytosis resolves. So it has an effect on cell adhesion that allows them to be mobilized, but again, very active agent in that setting.
Where does bendamustine fit into your practice nowadays? And in general, how do you think through the issue of R-chemotherapy up front in CLL?
So certainly there's been a longstanding use of fludarabine, rituximab, or the FCR regimen, adding cyclophosphamide. And the MD Anderson group has shown a very high level of efficacy with that regimen. One of the challenges of it is that it's immunosuppressive. It can be stem cell depleting, and there's a proportion of patients who end up with cytopenias that preclude sort of full use of that regimen. And it's not well tolerated in patients above the age of 70. And so typically in that setting, if you're going to use fludarabine, we would not include cyclophosphamide with it. So the bendamustine activity in CLL is quite high, as it is in indolent lymphomas. And many practitioners, including myself, have adopted bendamustine rituximab for especially older patients who are somewhat more frail. And I've used it in some younger patients as well who want to avoid some of the risk of fludarabine. So I think it's finding a place in frontline therapy and certainly in relapse therapy for CLL presently. And my anticipation is that's going to increase. So we'll see more bendamustine rituximab in frontline CLL.
We were talking before about R maintenance and FL and also about R upfront without chemo and FL. What about those two strategies in CLL?
Yeah, so the maintenance therapy in CLL is not as well developed. I'm not aware. There may be data out there that suggests a benefit in some populations, but typically the use of maintenance, say rituximab, as we use in indolent lymphoma, is not a standard. I think one of the things we're going to be interested in is trying to get deeper remissions, especially in patients with poor risk markers. So perhaps an induction therapy followed by something like lenalidomide and rituximab consolidation or one of the other agents to try to get a better control of disease for these patients who tend to have early progression.
You know, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is a very common disease in clinical practice, but it kind of seems like we kind of hit a plateau there. Anything new and exciting in both translational work as well as clinical research on that disease?
Well, I'd say that the translational work right now that's most relevant for diffuse large B-cell relates to, first of all, the now, 10-year database we have for separating them into those of germinal center origin and those that are non-germinal center or activated B-cell type. The latter tend to have a more aggressive clinical course and poorer outcomes with at least R-CHOP type therapy. We've now recognized through some translational work that there's a subset of about perhaps 5 to 7% of diffuse large B cells that have MYC translocations, and they have a poorer outcome, especially if you have a so-called double or triple hit large cell. So that's a MYC translocation with BCL2 and or BCL6. Those patients do very poorly with standard therapies. And even in our cooperative group studies, we're going to try to pull those patients out for alternative treatment approaches because they just don't do well with things related to R-CHOP. In terms of treatment of sort of the general diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patient that we see without any particularly poor risk factors like the MYC translocation, I think there's been a lot of interest in the last few years in using rituximab CHOP on a 14-day schedule. We now have randomized data from the French group to tell us that that does not have any clear benefit over R-CHOP 21, which remains the standard treatment for this disease. There's an important study that CLGB is directing right now, testing R-CHOP versus the dose-adjusted rituximab EPOC regimen, which is an infusional pharmacodynamic regimen where you dose adjust based upon nadir counts to try to overcome individual patient differences in their metabolism of the drug and therefore to try to get a higher proportion of complete and durable remissions.
One of the common questions we get from oncologists about diffuse large B cells is the issue of interim scanning. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, so our usual approach is to get a CT scan after 3 or 4 cycles. We don't use interim PET scans. Certainly in Hodgkin lymphoma, a negative interim PET has a very high negative predictive value for predicting that a patient's going to have a good outcome if they have a negative interim scan. That's been more difficult to show in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and I think right now outside of a study setting, that an interim PET is not indicated, and certainly we're not at a point where you would make major treatment decisions based on an interim PET finding. That said, a negative post-treatment PET scan in diffuse large B-cell is highly predictive of an improved outcome versus patients who have a positive post-treatment PET. So I think it's fair to say that's a useful and standard approach. So we always get a post-treatment PET somewhere around 4 to 6 weeks after they finish their chemotherapy.
So another question, I'm not sure how much new data there is on this, but I know people are very curious about in diffuse large B-cells, indications for CNS prophylaxis and how it's actually done.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and we could spend the hour talking about that alone. So there's no standard approach. There's no general agreement on which patients should be prophylaxed, and there's likewise no standard agreement on what prophylaxis should be if you decide a patient needs it. So things that have been used and I think are widely accepted as indications for CNS prophylaxis include sinus involvement by the large cell, testicular involvement. Softer calls are if you have large cell lymphoma in the marrow or in the GI tract. There have been some studies that suggest that if you have two or more sites of extranodal disease, so say bone and bone marrow or bone and GI tract, that that's a higher risk. So you may decide my patient's at high risk, maybe it's a younger patient with aggressive disease, you want to really be as aggressive as you can to get a good response. So then the question is, what do you treat them with? Traditionally, it's been doses of intrathecal methotrexate or perhaps cytarabine, but that only addresses, of course, occult cells in the spinal fluid. Many of the relapses in the CNS are in the parenchyma. And so it's unclear how much benefit you might get from intrathecal for that. So for our patients at high risk, we've been adopting more recently the use of two or sometimes three high-dose methotrexate administrations, usually at about 14 days after they finish an R-CHOP treatment. So say on alternate cycles of R-CHOP, they would get a day 14 high-dose methotrexate. That was published in a single institution overview with a large number of patients by Jeremy Abramson back, I believe, in July 2010 in Cancer. So it was the Mass General experience. And they, at least from what you would anticipate, would be the frequency of CNS relapse, that it appeared to have a very beneficial effect. So we'll use that. Whether it's the right thing or not, I don't know. And of course, older patients are not candidates for high-dose systemic methotrexate, or those who have renal insufficiency. So in that case, if we're going to do any prophylaxis, it'll be intrathecal.
So speaking of older patients, another common question that I'm not sure how much new data we have, but again, people are interested in, is the older patient with cardiac dysfunction, low ejection fraction, cardiac history. How do you approach induction treatment with diffuse large B-cell in those patients?
Yeah, so our approach is typically to substitute etoposide for the anthracycline, and otherwise it's basically an R-CHOP approach, but with etoposide for the doxorubicin.
Final question about diffuse large B-cell, the patient with HIV infection, how do you approach them?
So it's a fairly common presentation, although in the era of heart therapy for HIV, the frequency, fortunately, of these aggressive lymphomas is less than it used to be. But to my mind, the best data and the best tolerated regimen for these patients is the rituximab EPOC regimen. Wyndham Wilson's group at NCI and Kieran Dunleavy have presented and published this. So 3 or 4 cycles of treatment with rituximab EPOC, they typically will stop the heart therapy during the time they're on their chemotherapy just to avoid untoward drug-drug interactions. But that's been our approach. And interestingly, I mean, the response rates are high, and we've got a number of patients that remain in a durable remission after that.
So let's spend the rest of the time talking about mantle cell, which I know you've been so involved with. And I think a good way to get into this would be to go through your cases. Maybe you can start out with your 76-year-old man.
Sure. So I thought I'd put a few cases together that I thought would just illustrate some of the issues we deal with in mantle cell. Might be good to preface what I say by just reminding everyone that mantle cell was really just defined about 20 years ago as a distinct entity. And for the first decade, it was felt to be one of the poorest prognostic subtypes of lymphoma. If you read any of the literature from that time and before, it was suggested that the median survival is about 3 years. So it was a difficult disease to manage. That has changed dramatically now because we have much better understanding of molecular and cellular biology. We have a number of newer regimens and treatment approaches, some of which you brought up earlier. And we're starting to understand better the really marked heterogeneity of both the biology and the clinical presentation of these patients. So an example case that I thought would be worth discussing is an example of an indolent mantle cell lymphoma. Everybody thinks of mantle cell as being a uniformly, or at least many feel it's just a uniformly aggressive disease and they have to use a more intensive regimen. But about 20 to 25% of patients actually have more of an indolent B-cell lymphoma presentation. So an example is a patient, 76 years old, otherwise healthy, has some coronary disease that's under good control following stents, and was found to have an elevated white count on a routine exam and on an annual physical. He had splenomegaly, but no significant lymphadenopathy. The peripheral blood studies confirmed that it was mantle cell, so it had the 11-14 translocation, had the correct phenotype.
Incidentally, I'm kind of curious, initially when the white count was picked up, where I hear a lot of these patients are initially thought to have CLL. Is that what the thinking was with him?
That's exactly what it was. He was referred for a diagnosis of CLL, and it's very easy to miss because many of these indolent mantle cells present just like CLL, lymphocytosis, big spleen, minimal adenopathy, and if you don't do proper flow and if you don't include the 11-14 with your FISH panel for CLL markers, then you can miss it. But with that presentation, if their counts are otherwise good, they're asymptomatic, some of these patients will have a very slow pace of disease, and it's not essential that they be treated right up front. So it's important to recognize this clinical spectrum of disease and not overtreat the subset of mantle cell patients who may do well with deferred treatment or certainly less intensive approaches.
Any other sort of clinical pearls about pulling out these indolent cases? Any tissue assays, Ki-67, anything that people can look for?
Well, there actually is a fair amount of work on this in the last 2 or 3 years, and there are biologic and molecular correlates of the indolent subtype. For example, most mantle cells express a nuclear protein called SOX11. The indolents are negative for this. The indolents tend to have a very low Ki-67. They often have the 11-14 with little or no other karyotypic abnormalities, and they have a low proliferation signature at a cDNA array analysis will show that compared with other mantle cells and certainly the very aggressive, say, blastoid types, very different patterns. So they can be sorted out both clinically and from laboratory parameters.
So I'm curious how this man or maybe his family, if they were involved, reacted to the idea of watch and wait? Were they out there on the web reading about mantle cell? What do you see with patients with mantle cell when you bring this up as a possibility?
You know, it's a really good question and one that, as you suggest, a lot of people come in, and not just from what they've read, but they've often been informed that, well, you have to get right onto therapy. This is a bad lymphoma. And so it takes some education to kind of talk them back from that. And in this particular case, he was quite comfortable with being followed and continues to be followed now about 8 months out with stable counts, and he's had no clinical progression, so he's doing fine.
Just out of curiosity, same exact clinical situation in terms of the mantle cell, but let's say age 50 instead of 76, same thing?
With the indolent
presentation?
Yeah, I would definitely still watch those patients.
I'm curious, you know, I wonder what happens in clinical practice. We study a lot of things about how people practice, and you kind of think, again, with the reputation mantle cell has with a younger patient, that maybe even docs would be uncomfortable watching and waiting. Is that your sense?
That's definitely true. I see a lot of second opinions and consults for mantle cell, and one example is a gentleman who had had 3 other opinions before he saw me. One had recommended R-CHOP, 2 had recommended transplant, 1 immediate transplant after an induction therapy, the other one a planning transplant, but potentially deferring it. But he clearly had had an indolent pace of disease. He'd had nodes that he was aware of for over 2 years that hadn't changed a great deal, had a very low Ki-67 score, clinically asymptomatic. He was very healthy, retired professor who was very active. And so I recommended that we actually observe him. And he went about 2 years. He was in his late 60s at the time. Went about 2 years and then developed some disease progression and recently completed a course of bendamustine rituximab, and he's in a complete remission from that. So he's about 4 years now from when I first saw him.
I'm curious what your thoughts are in terms of new trials in mantle cell, new questions that are being asked, new agents.
Yeah, this is still a disease for which there's no standard of care. So there are a variety of active approaches. There's controversy about how best to induce patients and how to sequence therapies. So clinical trials are certainly a high priority in this disease, as in our field in general. The, I'd say, two U.S. trials right now that are most important would be the ECOG intergroup study. So this is predominantly for older patients and those who are not stem cell transplant candidates. And what we're testing with this group is a bendamustine rituximab backbone. So the patients will get either BR or bendamustine bortezomib rituximab as induction. And then there's two different maintenance options that patients will be randomized to, either rituximab single agent or the R-squared regimen. So it's going to test lenalidomide plus rituximab in the maintenance setting. For transplant-eligible patients, SWOG is heading up an intergroup study that's going to compare bendamustine rituximab versus rituximab hypercvad with methotrexate and cytarabine, and each of those for responders will be followed by an auto stem cell consolidation.
And, you know, that transplant trial is kind of interesting in terms of randomizing people. Have you actually put patients on that study?
We have not yet. That study is just opening, and we haven't got it open at our center yet.
Seems like it's kind of two pretty different paths for somebody to let the computer flip a coin on.
That's fair. I hope the accrual will go well. I mean, hypercvad has been, you know, a very standard approach for younger patients and people with higher risk disease. So it'll be interesting to see whether clinicians are willing to test these two inductions against one another.
You mentioned the study looking at bortezomib up front. Right now, outside of a clinical trial setting, where do you see bortezomib fitting in? Are there any situations where you'd be okay with including it up front?
Yeah, I think it's been tested up front in a variety of combinations. So certainly, I think things like the ECOG trial that's adding bortezomib to bendarotux is a reasonable approach. You know, it's an approved agent for relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. It's got an FDA indication for that. It has about a 35% response rate in relapsed or refractory mantle cell. The complete remissions are relatively small, but it's an active drug and certainly the agent that new therapies like ibrutinib or others will need to be compared to get their own registrational indication for that disease.
We're seeing rapid shift in the use of bortezomib and myeloma towards weekly and subcutaneous administration. Has that been looked into with mantle cell?
Yeah, the evidence is that the sub-Q is also active in mantle cell. So we've shifted, certainly for all of our myeloma patients, we've shifted to sub-Q administration, and we've used it as well for mantle cell patients.
You were talking about the trial and the older patients in terms of the issue of maintenance. What do we know about our maintenance right now in mantle cell, and how do you approach that issue in your own practice outside of trial?
Right. Well, we've got some clarity on that now as well. The European Mantle Cell Network that's chaired by Martin Drehling in Munich has been just really effective in conducting phase 3 trials in mantle cell lymphoma. The non-transplant study in older patients was just reported in the New England Journal in July by Dr. Kluwen Nellemans. So that tested rituximab CHOP versus rituximab fludarabine cyclophosphamide induction, followed by either an interferon administration thrice weekly or rituximab maintenance. The findings of that study were that RFC was more toxic and less efficacious than R-CHOP. but that for RCHOP patients, there was a clear benefit in duration of response and survival for rituximab maintenance versus the interferon regimen that was used. So with that, we've now adopted rituximab maintenance after induction therapy in our non-transplant patients, certainly if they get RCHOP, but I'm using it as well in patients who've had bendamustine rituximab induction. Although we don't have data for that as yet, that study has been done, just not yet reported.
What about in transplant patients?
Yeah, so less information there, but there have been a couple of different approaches for that, not randomized, so it's difficult to say what the benefit is, but some groups have given weekly times four rituximab for mantle cell patients after an auto transplant. So once they've engrafted, they get four doses of rituximab, and then 3 or 4 months later, they do another four weekly doses. So it's been looked at. Certainly, it's been shown that patients who have detectable minimal residual disease after transplant can convert back to MRD negative after rituximab alone. So there's a rationale for it, just not a lot of clear data yet.
I want to get onto your other cases, but first, in the younger, otherwise healthy patient that you want to treat for mantle cell, you can't get the patient on a protocol, what kind of induction strategy do you tend to favor?
Yeah. So for younger patients, our approach is a combination rituximab chemotherapy that incorporates high-dose cytarabine. So I think there's been important data from two or three studies, the Nordic trial that I mentioned earlier that included high-dose cytarabine with a transplant consolidation. Probably the reason hyper-CVAD, methotrexate-ARC, has had the response rates that it does is, it, at least in large part, due to the high-dose cytarabine on top of the CHOP-like component. And so, again, the European Mantle Cell Network, just about a year and a half ago at ASH, presented their study of RCHOP versus RCHOP alternating with RDHAP, so DEX, high-dose ARC, and platinum, followed by a transplant, an auto-transplant. And in the DHAP arm, they also got high-dose cytarabine with as part of their conditioning pre-transplant. The outcome of that study was that there was a benefit for the DHAP arm. And so I think the answer to your question for younger patients is that you need high-dose cytarabine as part of their induction. Right now, we are following the data from this phase 3 study. So we're using RCHOP, RDHAP, followed by an auto as our approach for younger patients. Other people still use the hyper-CVAD approach, but there's more toxicity with that regimen. The high-dose methotrexate is not something that everyone can tolerate. It's an active regimen, but you know, these are both toxic on various levels. RDHAP probably is a little better tolerated.
Let's talk about your next patient, the 69-year-old man.
Yeah, so I put a case in that was sort of a more standard presentation for mantle cell. You know, this is a disease predominantly of patients above the age of 60, and there's a 2 or 3-fold male predominance. So this was a 69-year-old man who's got diabetes and COPD, increasing fatigue, came in with peripheral adenopathy, and a biopsy showed that he had mantle cell lymphoma, non-blastic. He's mildly anemic and thrombocytopenic. Renal hepatic function are fine. His heart, you know, the MUGA scan was fine, so his heart works. So the question is, what do you do with that patient? Certainly, I would consider this gentleman with his comorbid problems and his age above 60, 65, not a good candidate for one of these intensive regimens that we just talked about. So our approach for that patient nowadays is to use bendamustine rituximab as the induction. RCHOP is a very standard regimen. It's probably the most commonly used in the community and by many of us to date, but you know, RCHOP in mantle cell, study after study has shown that you can certainly get very high response rates with it. That's not sort of the problem in mantle cell. We can get good responses with a number of agents. The problem is the durability is short. So a complete remission after RCHOP, the median duration of that progression-free survival is about a year and a half. So as I said, that is improved with maintenance rituximab, but we have found that bendamustine is better tolerated, and based upon the German data from Matthias Rummel that was presented at the ASCO plenary session this year, it showed a benefit in terms of both toxicity and response with bendamustine Rituxan, although it shows the same, you know, ongoing relapse rate as you see with R-CHOP. So by itself, it's not curing anyone. It's not giving very many patients at all a real durable response. So for a patient like this, I would use bendamustine rituximab followed by 2 years of maintenance.
So what actually happened with the patient?
He's on maintenance now, had a complete remission to the bendarutux, and so he's in the middle of his maintenance.
Great. How about your 55-year-old lady?
Yeah, so the last one I put in just sort of to lead us into some discussion about the role of transplants. So this was a 55-year-old woman who had very advanced stage 4B mantle cell. Again, it was non-blastoid, but she had bulky disease. She had splenomegaly. She presented actually with a small amount of rectal bleeding that turned out to be due to lymphomatous polyposis, which is a somewhat unique presentation for mantle cell. So she had advanced disease, and the question is what to do with her. So traditionally, we would have treated her either with 3 to 4 cycles of R-hypercVAD methotrexate RSC, so alternating cycles, 3 or 4 of each, and then potentially take her to transplant or follow. Nowadays, she would get R-CHOP, R-DHAP, followed by an auto transplant. So for a patient like this, she ended up actually, this was before the DHAP data came out, so she got R-hypercVAD, 3 cycles of each, went to an auto transplant, and relapsed at 18 months. With a periorbital mass and a soft palate mass. So at the time she came back to see me and had this documented progression, we biopsied it, we confirmed that's what it was. And she actually went on the ibrutinib trial, and she is now 17 months into that. She, by 2 weeks, had no detectable disease on ibrutinib. And I just saw her about 3 weeks ago. She got re-imaged, and she's still in a complete remission with ongoing ibrutinib therapy.
Any toxicity at all that you can determine in her?
So her toxicity has been, she had pretty impressive muscle and hand cramps for a time, especially like she would notice if she was driving, that gripping the steering wheel, her hands would tend to cramp. But that was mostly off and on during the first 6 months of therapy, and now it's a very minimal problem for her. But other than that, she's tolerated the drug just fine.
Any comments on the role of radioimmune therapy? We were talking about that before in mantle cell, and in what situation would it ever be a consideration in her?
Yeah, so for her, if we hadn't had the ibrutinib option for her, or let's say if she didn't respond to it or she now progressed, I think in any younger patient, you know, under the age of 60, 65, good performance status, otherwise very fit, I think there always has to be a consideration of allotransplant, because that is the curative approach. It's a pretty small subset of mantle cell patients who are eligible for that, but I think you always have to at least touch that base and decide, is that something we want to look into or not? Because if you're going to do it, you know, this sort of first relapse, you know, second remission, however you want to phrase it, that's when you should be thinking about an allo, because there is a graft versus lymphoma effect, and you can get cures with an allo approach. So I would be thinking about that. Now, if she weren't going to go there, then let's say we didn't have ibrutinib, then you'd be into either some other clinical trial. We just finished a trial with lenalidomide that's got activity, but bortezomib would be a very standard approach, either with or without rituximab. And, you know, there are a variety of other approaches.
I'm curious about the colonic involvement that she had. Was it ulcerating? Where was it present? Was she rescoped after treatment?
Right. So she had literally dozens or maybe even a couple of hundred polyps throughout the colon. They're mostly about a centimeter. A few of them were mildly ulcerated and bleeding. Interestingly, she, as in the case with some of my other patients who present with bleeding, even when you treat them, you'd be always fearful they're going to really bleed. But actually, she did fine with that. A repeat colonoscopy was negative.
Wow.
After her induction. It's interesting that there's a real tropism of mantle cell for the GI tract. The MD Anderson group has done routine upper and lower endoscopies as part of staging. And if you do blind biopsies of normal appearing mucosa, the mantle cell's there.
Any thoughts about what the biology is of this?
Yeah. There have been some reports of perhaps something related to their integrin profile. I don't know the specific proteins that might be mediating that, but quite interesting. Mantle cell in general tends to go to extranodal sites. So you see it in prostate, kidney, skin, orbit, the GI tract, of course. Curiously, CNS involvement is pretty uncommon. So it's probably only 5 to at most 10% perhaps, and it's usually a later event. It's very rare to present with CNS disease.
Prostate, that's one I'm not sure I've heard. Is that usually picked up symptomatically or by imaging?
Yeah. Well, I mentioned it because I've had two patients with it who were thought to have, you know, either just bad prostatic hypertrophy or perhaps a prostate malignancy, and they got biopsied and had mantle cell.
Wow.
So it's unusual, but can go to funny places.